The letter to the Ephesians, beginning at chapter 5, verse 15. Be careful then how you live, not as unwise people, but as wise, making the most of the time, because the days are evil. So do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And from the Old Testament, from the Psalter, Psalm 111. Praise the Lord. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. In the company of the upright, in the congregation. What are the beliefs that make you who you are? What beliefs make you who you are? Beliefs about God, or the world, or life, about what's good, what's essential, about what's worth living for, what's worth fighting for. What's worth dying for? What beliefs make you who you are? And what do those beliefs tell you about how God is inviting you to live this one life? What are the beliefs that make you who you are tell you about how God is inviting you to live this one life? And finally, how much difference does it make to you that you don't have to try to do this alone? Not without God, and not without these people whom you and I know as the congregation. In a book called A Short History of Nearly Everything, Bill Bryson made accessible the scientific hypothesis that there is no place where you can stand at the center of the universe and say, this is where it all began. This is the centermost point of it all. Bryson says, we are all at the center of it all. Actually, he said, we don't really know that for sure. We can't prove it mathematically. Scientists just assume that we can't really be the center of the universe. Think what that would imply. Although I think I've met some people who may have. Anyway. But that the phenomenon must be the same for all observers in all places. Still, he said, we don't actually know. Christianity, which in the disciples' time, I mean the first disciples of Jesus' time, was called the way, as in like the road, which is both the route to somewhere and the means of getting there. Christianity says that at the center of the universe, as we know it, as much or as little as we do, there is a cross. On that cross, someone named Jesus was crucified, who was the Son of God, the embodiment of what it means to be fully human, and the living revelation that the Creator of the cosmos loves all of creation, including each one of us, unrelentingly, and has put us here to bask in and embody and share that love abundantly. He befriended sinners and outcasts. He subverted the brutality of empires. He was called a king by some, but lived as a refugee and a transient. He critiqued religious and state powers and mob mentalities and was executed at the hands of them all, while loving them all to the very end, unrelentingly. He was raised from the dead by God, both proving and enacting the salvation and restoration that God wills for all creation, including you and me. The cross is the centermost point of it all, the crux of death and life, of giving and receiving, of physics and metaphysics, of the profane and the sacred, of humanity and divinity. We don't prove any of that mathematically. But you and I live out our lives there at the foot of the cross that stands at the center of the universe. During the earliest years of the church, a piece of writing was circulated among some of those first congregations. It has come to be called Ephesians, or the letter to the church at Ephesus. And Ephesians said, be careful then how you live. That's our translation. It literally says, how you walk. In other words, be careful how you go on your way, not as unwise people, but as wise, making the most of, or literally redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Because the days are evil doesn't mean all our days are satanic. Every day of each of our lives is a gift from God. It's not some inherently sinful blight or curse. The way the Greek reads to me, it seems like it's more like kind of a disposition toward the world. You know, in other words, it's kind of saying, as opposed to a guaranteed buffet of all-you-can-eat rainbows and sunshine every single day, the day itself couldn't actually care less about who you are. The day doesn't come to be good to you. If anything, you can probably expect most days to bring some trouble of one kind or another, particularly if you are not mindful. So don't be foolish, says Ephesians. But understand what God's will is. Allow yourself to be filled with God's Spirit and give thanks to God at all times and for everything. It's called Paul's letter to the Ephesians, but there's no compelling evidence that it was Paul's or a letter or specifically written to the Ephesians. It's actually more of a general testimony for all people of the way who were trying to live faithful lives in a disorienting time, and it was a disorienting time, when everything seemed subject to drastic change such had not been experienced in generations. But nobody could be entirely sure what was coming, what all was changing, or what all exactly was going to be left behind once the dust settled. A time when basically good, decent, thoughtful people couldn't even agree on basic, fundamental, observable truth. And everybody seemed most interested in winning some existential argument on points rather than on solving problems for everyone's benefit, let alone on doing what was right in God's eyes. I mean, I don't know if you can relate to a time like that, but just, you know, we can try to imagine. The other day, I saw a thing that's been going around on the internet, I guess, and it says, someone asked me if I had plans for the fall. And it took me a moment to realize they meant autumn and not the collapse of civilization. Be careful then how you live, how you walk, how you go on your way. And make the most of the time. Because not every day will automatically bring happiness and sunshine. So isn't it a good thing that we don't have to do this alone? It may have kind of felt like it for a year and a half or longer. But think of the miracles that have taken place amidst the tragedy, and it has been a tragedy and still is, of the last 18 months. Think of the goodness in people that has been revealed. Think of the giving. Think of the people bringing things and leaving things and helping and reaching out and becoming technologically proficient in things that before that was like, I'm never going to look at that. Amazing. It's a good thing we don't have to do this alone. Not without one another, and not without God. There's a movie that came out a few years ago, called, it was almost about 20 years ago now, called Open Water. It's a fictional account of a couple who on vacation went out on a dive boat, which is kind of a tourism thing for experienced deep-sea scuba divers. These boats take a group of people well out to sea for some deep-sea diving, and after a specified amount of time, everybody surfaces and gets back on the boat, and they do a head count, and the boat takes everybody back to shore. And you don't always know who all's on the boat, but it's just, you know, like a couple vacationing, for example, can go do this. So in this movie, Open Water, the plot is that due to a miscount and a late return to the surface, one couple finds themselves stranded in the middle of the ocean with only the gear that they're wearing and no sign of the boat. It's a real pick-me-up. The reason that movie comes to mind this morning has nothing to do with the plot, or not much to do with the plot. It's something that happened during the filming. I didn't mention this before, but this is a very, very small, independent film written, directed, and produced by one couple and starring two, at the time, virtually unknown actors. And they didn't use any movie sets. They went out onto the deep water to do the filming. So it was usually just a small boat out on the ocean for the husband and wife filming crew and the two actors who spent most of this movie in the water. One day, one of those four filmmakers spotted something on the far dim horizon, light gray against a lighter gray sky, the faint, tiny, ghostly image of an astronomically distant, large vessel, a freighter or a cruise ship. When you're making a movie on a shoestring budget, like I would know anything about that, but I'm told that when you're making a movie on a shoestring budget, you take every free prop you can get. So they quickly improvised a new scene for this movie, just to heighten the tension a little bit. They'd have the couple in the water see that dim outline on the impossibly far horizon and start, you know, waving their arms wildly in the, you know, infinitesimal and really obviously futile hope that they might be seen and rescued at that point. And then the ship would obviously just move on across the horizon and then go back to filming the original script. So they improvised this extra scene, the camera straining to see the tiny gray shadow on the horizon, and then they went on with whatever other scenes they were filming that day. A few minutes later, one of the production crew saw something unbelievable. That massive, impossibly distant ship was turning toward the spot where the actors had been waving their arms 5 minutes earlier. After some frantic radioing, the production team was able to communicate to the giant ship that we're just making a movie and it's okay. First of all, if you are a ship that enormous, whether you're an ocean liner or a freighter or a frigate or whatever, the idea that you would see a tiny, distant speck that you're not specifically looking for on the ocean from miles and miles and miles away just seems incredible. I didn't know that could happen. And apparently that misconception was equally obvious to the film crew, all of whom were experienced deep sea divers. Second, think of the physical energy and commitment, the power that is required to turn a vessel like that on the high seas. And then imagine a decision being made to do it without even knowing for sure if it's necessary. And third, just the economics of it. You've got to deliver thousands of people or millions and millions of dollars worth of inventory on a strict timeline. And if that timeline isn't met, there are enormous consequences. That giant ship had turned its massive hull and begun to lumber across the surface just for the possibility of coming to the rescue of the smallest and most helpless. When you are lost at sea, with endless horizon around you and no protection from the elements and an incomprehensible depth beneath your feet and predators circling and days and nights that couldn't care less. And there is, as Psalm 69 says, no foothold. And the only hope you can see, which has less probability of success than the wish that a child makes blowing dandelion seeds, is the faintest, most distant, ghostly shadow. Your simple distress signal, your faintest, most pathetic, ineloquent, desperate prayer, reaches out across the endless waves and the bottomless depths and crackles to life and is received loud and clear on the other end. The Lord is gracious and merciful, provides for those who fear him, sent redemption to his people, and has commanded his covenant forever. Holy and awesome is his name. Take heed then for how you go, not as the unwise, but as the wise, redeeming the time, because each day brings bad news for somebody. So don't be foolish, but understand what the will of God is. God opened the door wide for Solomon to ask for whatever somebody might wish for from the genie in the bottle, long life or titanic wealth, or for his enemies to get permanently put out of business. And with all of that on the table, Solomon said instead, "Will you just help me figure out what's right and be able to do it?" And God said, "Buddy, you just gave the right answer." What are the beliefs that are at the foundation of who you are? Beliefs about God or you or why anything exists at all. And what do those beliefs tell you about how God is inviting you to live this one life well? And how much difference does it make to you that we don't have to try to do this alone? I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart, in the company of the upright, in the congregation.